guitarist Doug Fritch opening up our Friday Current State, our live music Friday here. Doug is going to be accompanying Betty Baxter, who will be singing here for us in just a little bit this Sunday. Betty's going to be honored at the Jazz Alliance of Mid-Michigan 7th Annual Jam Tribute Concert at the Old Town Marquee in Old Town Lansing. So more from Betty Baxter in just a few minutes and more from her accompanist, the very talented Doug Fritch. It's Current State here for Friday. Glad you're along. I'm Mark Bayshore. As unionized General Motors workers near the end of voting on a new four-year contract, the tally so far suggests the pact will be approved. Voting continues today. Now, locally, UAW Local 652 and many other Michigan locals have approved the pact. Delta Township's UAW 602 votes today. Highlights of the agreement include $8,000 signing bonuses and a raise for all workers. Here to update the story and explain what the new four-year deal would mean is Mike Colias, GM beat writer for the Detroit-based Cranes Automotive News. Welcome, Mike.
Thanks, Mark. Thanks for having me.
Many observers appear to think that the contract will be ratified. Are you one of them?
Yeah, I do. It is looking more and more like that based on some of the recent results we've been seeing in the last 48 hours here. Some big plants got behind it. But, you know, early on it looked a little tighter than I think a lot of people thought. And I kind of point to the Fiat Chrysler agreement. Of course, last month they shot down their initial tentative contract and sent the negotiators back to the table and got a better deal. And I think a lot of GM workers might have been emboldened by that.
Talk to us broadly about why the GM pact is getting support.
Well, I mean, not everybody's happy with it, but I think there are two elements there. One is across-the-board wage increases, the first in a decade. And, you know, it's hard to be guaranteed built-in wage increases in any sector post-recession these days. So I think that weighed heavily. And then secondly, and this is an important point we can talk more about, but this two-tier wage structure that the union's been living under for the last 7 or 8 years.
Yes.
They improved that greatly, and they basically, there's an entry-level worker who makes much less than the so-called Tier 1 legacy workers, and this contract provides sort of a path for them to eventually get to full employment, and that was really important.
Well, go just a little bit deeper with us on the two-tier thing. How is that going to work?
Yeah, I mean, you know, going into these talks, I mean, the motto of the union was no more tiers, and they really didn't like. They kind of viewed this as a matter of inequality because those newer workers never had a shot at getting up to full wage. So what this does is it doesn't eliminate the two tiers totally, but it you know, if you get hired off the street, you know, a week from now, you'd start at $17 an hour, and then over the course of 8 years, you'd gradually increase to the top. To the top tier, which under this contract would be around $30. So, you know, it's something that I think that resonates very well with the workers who really saw this as a matter of inequality, and it's kind of turned it to more a matter of seniority, which is something I think union workers can wrap their heads around a little bit more easily.
But there are also wage increases apart from the two-tier measures here. Everybody will get a raise. And there are also signing bonuses for all members, correct?
Yeah, all of the both tier ones and two tiers, tier two will get $8,000, and even temporary workers will get a couple thousand. Those legacy workers, the tier one workers, which for GM is like 80% of their, I mean, they have about 53,000 union workers. You know, around 40,000 will get raises of 3% in the first and third year. They'll get lump sums in the other years. And, I mean, this is an important point, too. From GM's perspective, I mean, that signing bonus is going to cost them $400 to $500 million. But, you know, it sounds like a lot of money, but they don't mind that as much. I mean, they'd rather structure this as one-time payments so they're not on the hook going forward. It's not baked into their fixed costs. And all the Detroit companies are trying to structure it more that way. It just gives them, you know, it doesn't show up in their quarterly income statements that Wall Street sees every quarter, and it's just a way for them to have a little more flexibility if, you know, when the next downturn comes.
We're talking with Mike Colias. Mike covers the GM beat for Detroit-based Cranes Automotive News. Why are some workers opposing the proposal? What do opponents say?
Yeah, and it's clear. I mean, I think this thing's headed to ratification, but not everyone is happy with this. And I think the backdrop is, I mean, you've got to understand just how healthy the automakers are. I mean, you know, GM, maybe not the best timing, but a couple of weeks ago came out with their third quarter profits. They were a record for any quarter ever, over $3 billion in operating profit. All of that came from the U.S. The industry overall is on its way to maybe record sales this year of about 18 million vehicles. So, I mean, the industry's rebounded a lot more sharply than I think a lot of people expected. So if you're a plant worker who, you know, gave back concessions in 2007 and again in 2009, and, you know, if you haven't had a raise in a decade, you know, that's effectively like a 20% pay cut from what you had been making a decade ago. And so I think that's where a lot of the no votes are stemming from, and they feel like they could have clawed back more than this contract gives them.
Well, tell me then, how dependent are the higher wages and the signing bonuses on continued high sales? I mean, would a downturn in sales jeopardize what's in the contract?
Well, contractually, GM, you know, they're on the hook. They're going to have to pay these wages and the bonuses that are in, most of the bonuses that are included. The risk for workers would be on the profit sharing part of this, and that's become a nice component of their income. You know, workers got paid a $9,000 check last spring from GM's 2014 profits. I think they averaged over the current 4-year contract, they averaged a little over $7,000 in profit sharing. And so if things go south for GM, you know, if sales in China collapse or we have another recession here, you know, that's where workers would feel it over the next 4 years. And I think that's kind of what, I mean, that's what GM wants to do. I mean, they want to reward workers for when the company does well. And if the company doesn't do well, they feel like workers should share in some of that pain.
If the agreement's approved, Mike, how much pressure will it put on GM in the near future to send more jobs to Mexico or elsewhere overseas? I mean, can they live with this agreement, do you think, without doing that?
Yeah, I mean, that's a good question, because we have seen so much investment in automotive production in Mexico, not just from the Detroit companies, but the Europeans, the Asians. I mean, they're all building plants down there, the suppliers. I think for this contract, I think that the UAW leadership did a pretty good job of striking that balance between, you know, getting a really, really good terms for their members while at the same time not pressing GM to the point where they're going to run over the border and start building plants there. I mean, GM, it's not that no product will go down to Mexico. I expect that that will happen, but I think it'll be more than balanced by new stuff that comes to the U.S., and they've outlined $8 billion in plant investments in the U.S. that I think has given enough peace of mind to the UAW leadership that they're serious about continuing to build cars in America. So.
And to be clear, the leadership of the unions was really advocating passage to the rank and file. There was a pattern, though, at some plants I've read about where production workers supported the pact, but skilled trades workers opposed. Can you explain what's going on there?
Yeah, skilled trades, those are really good jobs. They're really coveted. They generally tend to be workers who've been around a long time. And they're the hardest ones to please. I mean, I think those people have been around for the good times. They saw how, you know, how lucrative it can be to be an auto worker at times. They also saw how deep the concessions were 8 or 10 years ago. And I think that they're just, relative to a younger worker, they're more inclined to voice their opinion and, you know, to say that they want to be made whole. And this contract just doesn't do it.
Their approval appears likely, at least a lot of reporters and observers seem to expect that. What would rejection mean, though? What kind of impact would that have?
I do think that, you know, compared to Fiat Chrysler, I think there's a lot more risk here on both sides. I mean, if, you know, I think that, you know, in the case of FCA, they quickly went back to the negotiating table. Here, like you said, I mean, I think the union leadership has really been clear that GM feels like this is the best deal that they could come up with, and you know, moving jobs overseas remains that ultimate threat. So, you know, if they shoot this down, I think a strike is a real possibility. I don't think that's what anyone wants. I know the company doesn't want it. I know that, you know, union workers, it's tough to make ends meet when you're getting paid very little out of the strike fund to survive through a strike. So nobody wants that. They could go back to the bargaining table. They could put GM on the back burner and turn to Ford and kind of let it sit. But I don't think it's a spot anyone wants to be in right now.
Mike Colias reports on General Motors for Crane's Automotive News in Detroit. We are talking about the prospective new four-year contract between the United Auto Workers and General Motors. Voting is nearing the end. The workers have had about a week or so to vote here, and locally we'll point out that Delta Township's UAW Local 602 votes today. A lot of observers seem to think that this thing is going to pass. Assuming it passes, Mike, will the majority feel good about this the morning after, or might a little bit of buyer's remorse set in, and might some number of people regret that they didn't ask for more?
I think that the leadership's done a good enough job in explaining the economic realities and the fact that GM feels like this, you know, sort of put its best foot forward here, and there's not a whole lot of wiggle room. I think that the first wages in a decade, you know, yes, they lost a lot in the last decade, but I think that that'll help. I think when you're looking at a $8,000 signing bonus, you know, that's double what the Fiat Chrysler workers are getting. It's more than the $5,000 that the GM workers got in 2011. So I think that'll help. You know, that buy some Christmas presents and get people feeling good about the contract. Not everybody, but probably the majority.
There was one really interesting development that I read about. I'd love to hear your thoughts on this. This happened in Arlington, Texas. No votes edged yes votes, 51-49%, and there was a much more resounding defeat by skilled trades, which we talked about a minute ago. 84% no, only 16% yes. And what really makes this interesting to me was that GM is investing more than $1 billion in Arlington, a huge investment in that plant. Why would workers at a plant that's being invested in like that reject what's being viewed as a pretty good offer?
Yeah, that is a good question. I mean, Arlington is... they're going to get more money in terms of investment than any plant in the U.S. over the next 4 years. I think $1.2 billion, and I mean that reflects how important that plant has become for GM. It's where they make their big Tahoe and SUV and the GMC Yukon and yeah. Cadillac Escalade. I mean, hugely profitable trucks that are really hot right now because of a pretty nice redesign they did a couple years ago. I think what that shows you is, and we've seen this in past contracts where the locals, the further away you get from Michigan, I think that those locals tend to have a little more of an independent streak in them. They maybe aren't as beholden to what the UAW leadership is sort of telling them to do, and they're just not going to be as influenced by UAW. You know, they see fewer UAW officials walking through the plant and telling people how great the contract is and we really need to get behind this thing. They see less of that, and they're less inclined to sort of fall in line.
Assuming the GM contract is approved, Mike, what lay ahead here in the larger process? I mean, that leaves Ford. What happens if the GM contract is approved? What lay ahead?
Well, it takes effect right away for GM, and then, you know, if the pattern holds from what they did with Fiat Chrysler, the union, you know, will probably, even over the weekend, if not by early next week, they'll pivot immediately to Ford and probably give them 48 or 72 hours to come up with a final contract, effectively setting a strike deadline. That doesn't seem like a whole lot of time, but you've got to remember that these guys have been negotiating for months and months and months now, and they've already got the pattern, right? The template has been set, so I wouldn't expect in the Ford contract to see a whole lot different, at least on the big stuff like the Tier 2 wage system. You're going to see a lot of the same thing, so it may not take all that long for them to get something done.
We want to thank Mike Colias. Mike covers the GM beat for Crane's Automotive News in Detroit. We've been talking about the final hours here of voting by UAW workers for General Motors on the proposed four-year contract. Mike Colias, thank you.
Thanks, Mark. Thanks for having me.
Tall and tan and young and handsome, the girl from Ipanema goes walking. And when she passes, each girl he passes goes, mm-mm. When he walks, it's like a samba that swings so smooth and sways so gentle. And when he passes, each girl he passes goes, mm-mm. Oh, but I watch him so sadly. How can I tell him I love him? Yes, I would give my heart gladly. But each day when he walks to the sea, he looks straight ahead, not at me. Tall and tan and young and handsome, the boy from Ipanema goes walking. And when he passes, I smile, but he doesn't see. Watch him so sadly. How can I tell him I love him? Yes, I would give my heart gladly. But each day when he walks to the sea, he looks straight ahead, not at me. Tall and tan, young and handsome, the boy from Ipanema goes walking. And when he passes, I smile, but he doesn't see. No, he doesn't see. He doesn't see me.
Betty Baxter performing live in Studio West along with Doug Fritch on guitar. You can't go wrong with Joe Beam. The boy from Ipanema there. That will be in my head for the rest of the day. But sometimes bad songs get in there, so at least a good song gets in there to start out the day. More from Betty Baxter and Doug Fritch coming up in just a little bit on A Current State Live Music Friday. I'm Mark Bayshore. Thanksgiving will be upon us sooner than we think, and you may be using some old family pieces of Pyrex to cook the old green beans. It turns out some of those pieces of Pyrex may be collectibles. 2015 marks the 100th anniversary of Pyrex, and this weekend in Dearborn, one of the oldest glass shows in the U.S., will be celebrating Pyrex. Current State's Jamie Paisley joins me after taking a tour with the president of the group, putting on the show. Hi, Jamie.
Hey there. Jonathan Furman is the devoted president of the Michigan Depression Glass Society. And in fact, Jonathan told me that one of the reasons he chose his particular house outside of Detroit was the space that's above the kitchen, where it was perfect to display his Pyrex above the shelves. And in addition to the very colorful glass displays throughout the house, there is a small set of rather frankly odd-looking light green glassware featured as well, which might have you reaching for your handy Geiger counter.
Vaseline glass, and it's glassware that has a green color. Not all green glass is Vaseline, and it's actually really tricky to tell what is and what isn't. To a really, really trained collector, you'll know, but the easiest way is to take out a black light, which you can get at online or actually at pet supply stores. And Vaseline glass actually has uranium in it, which is what gave it the green color. And when you put it under a black light, it's got a magnificent glow to it. And is actually very, very prized and valued by collectors.
I thought Halloween was last week.
It was, but there's collectors who display it year-round. We actually have a member of our club who has cabinets of Vaseline glass in her house, and she has them lit with both traditional lighting as well as black lights, and she can flip a switch and toggle between the two and have kind of a regular soft shade of green during with regular light and then go into this eerie glowing green with the black light.
And it's still safe, though.
Yes, it's completely safe. I know it does sound a little scary because it's got a bit of uranium in it, but it's very, very low and is actually depleted uranium and is completely safe to eat off of, use, and display.
And most of the stuff is fairly translucent, even the color ones, but that one is very opaque, exceedingly opaque.
Yeah. So really with any glass, the color is really just achieved by what chemicals you put inside of it. So whether you have gold, which might create more of a cranberry color, or silver, which will create a blue. So the color of a glass is really determined by what chemicals were put inside of it to give it that color. And then something like this, not only would you have the chemicals to give it color, but there would be a process of dipping it in acid to give it a more satinized finish.
How do you define Depression-era glass?
Depression glass is really glassware that was made during that era of the 20s, 30s, and 40s, but lower-end glassware. So this would have been stuff that was really given away for free and often is premium items. So actually what happened with around the time of the Depression is that was right around the time in glassware manufacturing that they were really coming up with ways to produce at higher quantities. So innovative manufacturing techniques that would allow them to really mass produce things. But unfortunately, the game plan was to then sell everything at kind of five and dime shops. But when the Great Depression hit, people didn't even have 5 or 10 cents to spend on frivolous things like glass. So what these manufacturers did is teamed up with various businesses and really kind of created premium items and for brand loyalty. So you might go to a movie theater one week and get a cup and saucer in a pattern. You might go the next week and get a plate and then the matching platter. And same thing with a gas station. It would have been in laundry detergent, oatmeal, anything like that. And by buying the same brand week after week, you'd collect different pieces and eventually be able to have a full set.
And that's why there's an oatmeal can there as well.
Yeah, so I actually have an oatmeal can. It says Crystal Wedding Oats. And I also have the matching glass that came in that particular can of oatmeal. I actually have a collection of the Candlelight Etching by the Cambridge Glass Company. And that would have been produced probably about the mid-1930s to the late 1950s. And what Cambridge did and what many other glass companies did is they actually took crystalware and then applied etchings to it, which is a really interesting process. They would, in order to really get these intricate etch patterns, what they need to do is dip the piece in acid, and the acid would etch in an intricate design. So in the case of this candlelight pattern, it's a medallion that is surrounding a lit candle, but other etch patterns are could be florals or fruit or figures and that kind of stuff. So in order to create that etch pattern, they would actually dunk the glass into acid, and that acid would create the etching. But therefore, any place that wasn't supposed to be etched would need to be covered up with wax. So they'd actually have a whole process to cover the goblet in wax and make sure that only the etched parts got the design on them.
There's a utility to most of the glassware that we've been seeing, but there is one item that seems to, one of these things is not like the other.
The bird here.
Yes.
Yeah, so that's actually a figurine that was made by the Fenton Art Glass Company. So while primarily most of this glass is utilitarian and, you know, people collect everything from entire sets of dinnerware to just things like candlesticks or candy dishes that they might use at Christmas time, there are a couple of objects that are purely decorative. Actually, several glass companies, including Fenton, made decorative figurines in the form of animals. So this here is a little bird in kind of a satin custard color with a little bit of few blue jays painted on it. There's a variety of other companies that produced glass figurines that could be something small like this piece, which is maybe only about 6 inches, up to something larger like a rooster that might be 10 or 12 inches. And actually, the Heise Glass Company of Newark, Ohio, produced an extensive line of figurines like that, and was actually used in filming the movie The Glass Menagerie.
What is the most valued piece that you have?
Well, I'd say from a sentimental standpoint, it's probably the collection of pink cherry blossom that I inherited from my grandmother. And that's actually what got me interested in Depression glass, was that my grandmother had this set of cherry blossom, which she actually didn't even get during the Depression. She bought in the 1970s. just when it was at the Goodwill and nobody was knew what it was really that interested in it, and she liked pink, so she bought that set. And when I was a kid and growing up and, you know, spending time at my grandparents' house, she would always serve lunch on these pink glass dishes, which at the time I had no idea what they were. And we were packing my grandparents up and moving them out of Detroit about 16, 17 years ago. And my grandmother hadn't cooked in several years because of Alzheimer's and dementia. So all that glass had been packed away. And when we were moving them out, I saw all this and it brought back all those childhood memories. And I thought, oh, this is really interesting. So I started talking to my mother about it. And she said, oh, well, there's actually this glass collecting club in Livonia that meets monthly. And they also have an annual show every November. And she said, I haven't been to one of the shows in many, many years, but we should go sometime and check it out. And, you know, even though there's this one pattern here, there's hundreds and hundreds more. So that's actually how I found out about the Michigan Depression Glass Society, which I'm the current president of. And I went to my first glass show about 15 years ago and was instantly hooked. And I've been a member and active in the club ever since.
What will you be bringing this weekend of your collection? Or will you bring anything?
So we're having a big display. Each year, the club kind of has a different theme. So in addition to the 25 dealers that are selling glass at our show, we also have a display area that the club puts on to really educate people about a particular type of glass and also give them ideas on how to use and display it. And this year, we were kind of dividing the display into two sections to celebrate some milestone anniversaries. In 1915, the first piece of Pyrex glassware was produced, so 2015 marks their 100-year anniversary. And also in 1915, the Fostoria Glass Company produced their first full line of tableware called Fostoria's American Pattern. And even though they're no longer in business, that pattern started production 100 years ago. So we're kind of celebrating those two milestone anniversaries. So I'll be bringing some Pyrex for the display as well as some Fostoria American pieces.
It is considered, amongst collectors, the most successful pattern in the history of glassmaking.
Fellow member of the Michigan Depression Glass Society, Jennifer Gannum.
Fostoria made American from 1915 through 1983 when Fostoria was sold to the Lancaster Colony Company. Lancaster continued making American into 1986 when they just stopped producing glass under the Fostoria name. Pyrex was the first product that came to the market that took a glass and tempered it in such a manner that it could go from the refrigerator to the oven to the table and back to the refrigerator, and gave the homemaker, the cook, a new easy way to heat food. I actually have a very exciting piece that I'm displaying at the show this weekend. It is a 10-sided pie plate in an original carrier. It's a rare piece. I did pick it up over the last few months. There is a version of it identical to it that is in the collection of the Corning Glass Museum. It's a very hard to find piece. So again, we're excited to be displaying items at our glass show this weekend that people might otherwise literally have to drive to a museum to see because they are that unusual and hard to find.
It can be seen this weekend where?
This weekend at the Ford Performing and Community Arts Center in Dearborn. It's at the intersection of Michigan Avenue, which is US 12, and Greenfield Road. The show is open Saturday, November 7th, from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m., Sunday, November 8th, from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. We encourage people to come early because the first 200 attendees each day are going to get a commemorative Pyrex authorized shopper pin, which we know is going to be very, very popular.
On both days?
200 people, the first 200 paid attendees each day.
You can find more information about this weekend's glass show at the Ford Community and Performing Arts Center in Dearborn, Michigan, over at michigandepressionglass.com, where you can also find out more about that society. Jonathan and Jennifer, thanks very much for this tour.
Thank you.
Thank you for coming. This was really wonderful.
For Current State, I'm Jamie Pace.
Guitarist Doug Fritsch, live in Studio S here on a Live Music Friday on WKAR's Current State. More from Doug and singer Betty Baxter, who is being honored here this Sunday by the Jazz Alliance of Mid-Michigan, their 7th annual Jazz Jam tribute concert at Old Town Marquee in Old Town Lansing. More from Betty and Doug coming up in just a few minutes. Hope you can stick around. We're into November now, and the holiday shopping season is kicking into high gear. In the weeks to come, billions of tons of cargo will be flown around the world. The entire global air freight industry can be traced back to one man, a daring pilot who once lived just 20 miles from Lansing's airport. Philip Parmalee grew up in St. John's. He learned to fly from Orville Wright himself, and on November 7, 1910, Parmalee carried a bundle of silk cloth in an hour-long flight whose details have been largely forgotten. Current State's Kevin Lavery spoke with Pete and Alice Murphy. They're a retired couple from St. John's who share a passion for aviation. Kevin asked Pete Murphy how they first heard about Philip Parmalee, who went by the nickname Skyman.
I think we first learned of Parmalee at the Capital City Airport from the historical marker that's there that explains what his role was in early aviation.
Now, were you living here in St. John's when you first discovered who he was?
No, at that time we were living in East Lansing, and it wasn't really till we moved here that it registered, oh my gosh, this is where that guy Parmalee was from, the one known as Skyman.
Alice, what do you know about this barnstormer, this daredevil of a bygone era, Phil Parmalee?
Well, Phil Parmalee was born in Matherton, Michigan, which is a small rural town in the very northwestern corner of Clinton County. And he spent his formative years there. We think he traveled in other places with his family before moving back to St. John's in about 1903, after his mother passed away. He and his father moved back here to St. John's, and they both worked as mechanics in the same company here in St. John's building motors. He was very mechanically inclined. He loved engines and had a real facility at fixing them and building them. And he lived here for at least a few years with his father. And then he moved to Mansalona, Michigan, where he worked for another engine company. And there he was discovered by a representative from Buick. And he was hired because of his talents, and he became part of their demonstration team. He drove their cars throughout the South and the East on long tours, showing that the Buick was very sturdy and could handle the roads or non-existent roads of the time and actually get from point A to point B successfully. And while he was on one of these tours, he visited the Wrights Flying School in Montgomery, Alabama in the winter of 1909, and he was bitten by the flying bug. And so he took the flying course in Dayton from the Wright brothers. Orville taught the students. And that would be the summer of 1910. And as soon as he finished his instructions, he was hired by them as a demonstration pilot and started demonstration flying in September of 1910. And that's why he was chosen to take a commercial package from Dayton to Columbus, which he became very famous for.
So, Pete, take me back to that day in Dayton, Ohio. It's November 7th, 1910, 105 years ago. And this was sort of a promotional stunt for a local company in Ohio.
Yes, indeed. Max Morehouse, who was owner-operator of this major department store in Columbus, asked if they could fly him a cargo shipment of French silk, which at the time was not easy to get, in short order anyway. The morning of the actual flight, everyone gathered around the Wright Flyer B model in Dayton, and it was a cold day, and Parmalee suited up in motorcycle gear, motorcycle mask, and three layers of sweaters and so on, and pants, and hopped aboard, and off he went. He flew up to around 2,000 feet, where it was freezing cold, it was shivering. And he kept turning the plane slightly to the south, trying to get some of the warming rays of the sun. But of course, he had to go east to Columbus from Dayton. So 66 minutes later, he arrived in Columbus, having followed railroad lines, roads, and so on, his only navigation system being a road map. He had no compass, even.
Wow. And we should mention, too, that on that flight, he had his map fastened in some way to the skids of the plane, so he had to look down all the time.
Yeah, exactly. So he was looking down, looking for roadways, looking for railroad tracks, and this is from about 2,000 feet altitude. So this was seat of the pants flying to the extreme. And keep in mind, there's no cockpit, no windshield. He's out in the open in this rickety airplane only 7 years after the first flight at Kitty Hawk. He lands in Columbus and the city goes crazy. The sirens are blaring, horns tooting, factories, you know, blowing all their big lunch hour horns and so on. And thousands of people show up and he lands and he's an instant hero. And it was another 20 or so years before the shipment of cargo by aircraft really became common. So he was definitely the earliest and was very famous for it. I would just add to this that keep in mind, this was 17 years before Lindbergh. We think of Lindbergh as the ultimate pioneer pilot. Well, Parmalee had 17 years on him and actually did many, many more things than Lindbergh did in terms of breaking records and doing demonstrations and so on. And this flight to date to Columbus, delivering the silk, was just one tiny part of his career.
We're talking with Pete and Alice Murphy, aviation enthusiasts and collectors of memorabilia. We're talking about Philip Parmalee, who lived more than 100 years ago here in St. John's, Michigan, a pioneering aviator in his day, even in the era before Charles Lindbergh. Alice, I wonder if you ever think of Philip Parmalee every time you see a UPS plane or a FedEx plane at the airport.
Not always, but when I do think of Parmalee, it certainly comes back. I mean, he was the very first commercial pilot in the world. Very few people at the time ever thought of airplanes as anything but just entertainment. A few people knew the potential, and certainly those early flyers were very dangerous and very rickety, but they were the first steps to the airplanes that came along later and became very commercially feasible to move the mail, move packages, move people. All of this within 15 or 20 years of that first flight was happening around the United States, all because of those early steps of pilots like Parmalee.
The military was interested in Phil Parmalee as well. He was the first pilot ever to drop a bomb from a plane, which proved itself time and again, perhaps not so much aerial bombing, but certainly dogfighting in World War I, which was less than a decade after he did his stunt, his maneuver.
That's very true. The Wright brothers initially tried to sell their airplane just through the military because that's where they thought the money would come from. And they kind of had to be convinced that these demonstration flights around the country at air shows would be a good way to sell their airplanes to individuals and to also sell their flying service of training pilots. Parmalee worked with both the civilians and with the military. He flew along the border with Mexico and proved that the airplane could be used as great spotters for people like Pancho Villa to keep them out of our country. You're right, he dropped bombs and showed that that was feasible. He also took pictures from airplanes that show you could reconnaissance that way. I think he was the first to transmit telegraph messages from an airplane to the ground. He did many of these things to prove that it was feasible and that these were all ways to sell an airplane.
But who's ever heard of the guy? And I guess that's the point, right?
Very true. Well, our country tends to be kind of like that. Unless we have some long-term enduring way to keep a person's name in the public eye, they tend to be forgotten, which is too bad, because he truly was more famous, I think, than, or at least as famous as Lindbergh in his day when he performed his feats in 1910.
Philip Parmalee died at the tender age of 25. Pete, what happened to him?
Parmalee died in 1912. It was in June. He was at an air show in North Yakima, and the weather was not good, and his mechanic who was with him pleaded with him not to go up. But Parmalee said he was not going to disappoint the spectators, some of whom had driven long distances to be there. So he went up, and it was windy, gusty, and he was flying this relatively new model airplane that was not the right flyer, and got caught in a gust and came down in an apple orchard and died immediately. And Turpin, his partner, who had been in Seattle, immediately quit flying himself, got to North Yakima, and personally escorted Parmalee's body back to St. John's. But the point is, he was a brave guy. He was not about to disappoint people who wanted to see him fly, and he died as a result of that.
Just a testament to the American spirit that people continued in spite of the dangers, in spite of those who lost their lives, and the pilots all knew, buddies who died, they kept on because they just loved it. The speed, the danger, they lived for it. And others took their place and continued on, eventually got safer, and we have what we have today because of them.
Pete and Alice Murphy live in St. John's, Michigan, and a few years ago they co-wrote an article in Michigan History Magazine on the life of Philip Parmalee, the first commercial air pilot. Alice, thanks so much for sharing the story of the life of Philip Parmalee.
Well, thank you for coming and interviewing us. It's been delightful.
Pete, thank you so much.
Well, thank you. It's been great to have you here.
For Current State, I'm Kevin Lavery.
And today's Live Music Friday guest, Lansing jazz singer Betty Baxter, here in Studio S. On Sunday, Betty will be honored at the Jazz Alliance of Mid-Michigan's 7th Annual Jam Tribute Concert at the Old Town Marquee in Old Town Lansing. She is joined here in Studio S at WKAR by guitarist Doug Fritch. We'll talk with Betty and Doug about the music and about her career in this weekend's concert here. First, we'll hear some music. This is Betty Baxter and Doug Fritch. Meet me where they play the blues.
I've got a heart that's broken-hearted. How can I mend it? I've got a sigh and cry that started. How can I end it? If you're feeling gloomy, come running to me. Meet me where they play the blues. People have said they've seen you dance in hideaway places. People have said you find romance in others' embraces. But if your mood is dreamy and you care to see me, meet me where they play the blues. Eyes that flirt with a tear are common round here, and misery loves company, they say. So I linger till dawn while the trumpet wails on, hoping you'll happen this way. I'm getting tired of sipping wine and watching it bubble. How did our dreams get out of line and wind up in trouble? But honey, if you're learning, there's a flame still burning. Meet me where they play the blues. Misery loves company, they say. So I linger till dawn while the trumpet wails on, hoping you'll happen this way. I'm getting tired of sipping wine and watching it bubble. How did our dreams get out of line and wind up in trouble? But honey, if you're learning, there's a flame still burning. Meet me where they play. Find me where they play. And meet me where they play the blues.
Meet me where they play the blues. Betty Baxter and Doug Fritch live in Studio S here on WKAR's Live Music Friday. Welcome.
Thank you very much for inviting us today.
And congratulations on the honor coming up on Sunday. The Jazz Alliance of Mid-Michigan paying tribute to your career of almost 60 years. How does that feel? What's planned?
Well, as far as the tribute is concerned, yeah, they're going to have all kinds of wonderful guests there. Sonny Wilkinson, Betty Joplin, Ramona Collins will be singing. There'll be MSU jazz professors, Jeff Kressler on piano, Terry Newman from Schwartz Creek on bass. Jeff Hall is coming up to play saxophone. There are so many people, I can't even begin to mention them all, and I understand there will be surprise guests because they're pulling stunts on me. So,
last February, the honoree of this event was Betty Joplin, and she was a Live Music Friday guest here on Current State as well. And I understand that Betty Joplin played a role in your career, in your early live performances.
Oh,
tell us
absolutely
about that.
Absolutely. I was working for the state Senate at the time. And I don't know why I got on a conversation on the telephone with Betty Joplin, who was then working for, like, military affairs or something. And I had heard that she sang at the garage. And she invited me to come down and sing with her. Mm. So after work one night, I took my briefcase and my little, you know, white suit or white shirt suit, whatever you look like when you're in the office. And I wandered down to the garage and I went in there and listened to her sing. And I was sitting at the front row, and I thought, oh, my God, she's so wonderful. I would never be able to come anywhere near her. So I snuck out, and she called me at the office the next day, and she said, was that you sitting in the front row with the briefcase? And I said, you know, it was. And she said, you get back in here and sing.
Oh.
And so the next time I went in, I sang, and everyone responded so wonderfully. And she encouraged me in my career. And when I made the first cassette recording, I credited her on the J card for her influence in
my life. Well done. Quite a relationship there. Doug Fritch, have you known Betty a long time?
Yeah, I've known Betty about 3-4 years now.
And you've played together all that time?
Yeah. Yep.
How does it? What's it like accompanying a singer like Betty?
You have to really keep in mind what the vocals are going on. You know, you have to play a little less sometimes, pay attention to the melody.
Mm-hmm. In almost 60 years of singing, Betty, you've worked with and met too many musicians to mention, but who were a couple of the most memorable?
Fred Mitchell Jr. was the most memorable because when I met Fred was at that point that I became a jazz singer. Because before I met Fred, I was doing musical comedy and summer stock theater and that sort of thing, a little bit of James Taylor, a little bit of silly songs, comedy, as I said. And then I met Fred Mitchell, and he asked me if I liked Bill Evans, and I said, where does he play? So then I found out who Bill Evans was, and I started getting his piano music and listening to his recordings and trying to play like him on the piano. And that was the day I turned into a jazz singer, and I've never gone back.
Now, along with singing, you've also done extensive research into the work of composers from Michigan. Tell us a little bit about your Michigan Music Research Project.
I started looking for Michigan composers of popular music when I was asked to sing at the sesquicentennial ball at the Capitol. And I found that it was very difficult to get any history. I had to go to the Michigan room to find anything at all, and then went on to the Detroit Library and did extensive research there, and then more research with Benjamin Britten at the U of M. And then Jerry Mattson, who is a professor here at MSU, gave me access to all of his sheet music and let me go through it and pull out everything that was written by a Michigan composer.
And this is all with you now, or?
It's all with me, or it's in the archives at the library, the Michigan Historical Library, because I did all the research in their computers.
Well, we want to hear you perform again here. We'll leave it at that. We'll remind everybody that Betty Baxter has been our Live Music Friday guest today, along with guitarist Doug Fritch. On Sunday, she's the honoree at the Jazz Alliance of Mid-Michigan's annual Jam Tribute Concert at Old Town Marquee on East Grand River. The show's from 2 to 5, but doors open at 1:30. The Doug Fritch Trio will be playing to open the show at that time. So congratulations, Betty Baxter. I'll remind our listeners here that coming up Monday, we catch up with Congressman Mike Bishop about how he thinks Paul Ryan's speakership is likely to affect the U.S. House of Representatives and what Congress gets done in the future. I'll leave it at that and let the musicians play. Doug Fritch and Betty Baxter, play us out on Current State. Have a great weekend.
Should care. I should go around weeping. I should care. I should go without sleeping. Strangely enough, I sleep well. Except for a dream or two. But then I count my sheep well. It's funny how sheep can lull you to sleep.